From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, an update on the work of the Periscope Project, which aims to help providers serve new mothers with mental health issues.
Later, a film that tells the story of a legendary and important Los Angeles nightclub and its founder.
The film is really an unwritten textbook. It's an example of how one person can make a difference, how they can take their life and serve their community in a lot of different ways.
Plus, local band Buffalo Gospel returns to Lake Effect with a preview of their latest album, which was 5 years in the making.
On a personal level, a lot of things have happened, and that's kind of what delayed the second album. I was in a much darker place 5 years ago, and I'm in a much lighter place now, so I'm having a lot more fun doing this stuff for sure.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Doctors define the perinatal period as running from before conception through a woman's pregnancy all the way to a year postpartum. It's a time when women go through many changes physically and mentally. But for women who struggle with mental health or substance abuse issues, these changes can not only affect the mother, but the child as well.
There are lots of doctors that specialize in the physical health of mothers, but there is a drastic shortage of specialists in the perinatal psychiatric care providers. To address this need, the Medical College of Wisconsin and UW-Milwaukee have joined forces with the help of a grant from the United Health Foundation to launch a new primary and psychiatric healthcare program, the Periscope Project.
The project uses a variety of tools, resources, and technologies to better serve mothers struggling with mental health and substance abuse disorders. Since its launch last summer, the project has released a follow-up report that examines how the first 9 months have gone.
During Maternal Mental Health Awareness Week, we're joined by Dr. Christina Wickman, who is the medical director of the Periscope Project, and Dr. Jennifer Deering, an associate professor in the College of Nursing at UW-Milwaukee. Dr. Wickman starts by sharing what they have heard from providers.
So we've had phenomenal feedback, and so we launched, like you said, back in July of 2017, so about 9 months of operation under our belts. For the providers who have utilized us and have completed our kind of follow-up survey, and I'm really proud of the fact, I know Jennifer is too, that we have a 70% completion rate of our satisfaction survey, which is pretty unheard of. 100% of them are satisfied with the teleconsultation that they received, and 100% of them said that they would not only utilize that information for that individual patient that they called for, but also be able to disseminate that information to other patients within their practice.
So what areas of care do you find that doctors are asking the most questions about when they do call you?
By far and away, it's about medication use, either in pregnancy or with breastfeeding. So about 80% of our calls have a psychopharmacology or medication component to them. The second most common is utilizing that community resource database. So about 25 to 30% of the time, we're also providing a community resource to that provider who's calling in.
I know last time we talked, we spoke of the difference in the kind of shift to getting doctors to allow mothers to stay on medications, that it doesn't necessarily pose as big a risk as was once previously thought. So do you find that doctors are also shifting their perspective on this?
We are. And certainly the providers that are utilizing our service, they may already be more inclined to be treating women who have mental health or substance use disorders just by virtue of utilizing our service. But they certainly feel much more competent and comfortable in prescribing, recognizing that they've got the backup of a subspecialist behind them.
With providers and reaching out to communities, a large percentage of the groups that have used your resource is Frederick for almost 50%. And then we have some community things as well, like the 16th Street Clinics outreach. And then we have some bigger ones, Ascension and Aurora, but they're still hovering around that 10% area. So what would you like to see to change for those massive providers like Aurora and Ascension to be able to adapt this program as well?
So those numbers are even shifting month by month. We're seeing that Aurora and Ascension and our federally qualified health centers are becoming a bigger piece of the pie, for lack of a better term, and as our numbers grow. I certainly think that Frederick and the Medical College have the biggest percentage right now because they know me, and I'm vetted with them. And so it was easy to reach out to the providers who knew about me and knew about our project internally to begin with, and then to expand from there. So we're already seeing some some shifting of those percentages. And ideally, I'd like to see those percentages grow. I know that some of our leadership in Aurora is having a bit of a competition among the clinics themselves to see who can really utilize this service and why aren't we utilizing it more. So that's exciting to see.
Jennifer, last time you were here, you spoke that you wanted to create this program to be as streamlined as possible when it comes to teleconsultation, the community resources, the database that you build from there, and provider education. So what kind of results did we see from this report about that?
I would argue that our enrollment process is perhaps one of the easiest models out there, and that that is catalyzing our success. If a provider can call in and get the help that they need on the spot, and either enroll there or pre-enroll through one of Dr. Wickman's educational sessions, that this is one of the reasons we have 330 providers enrolled to date.
And the response time, amongst other things, are far surpassing your original goals. So the original goal was 30 minutes average of response time, and what do you find that the turnaround rate is?
Yeah, so right now the turnaround time on average is about 9 minutes. So by the time a provider calls in and is triaged by our triage coordinator, I'm calling back typically in about 9 minutes or so. Now, we still have the 30-minute window just to give us a little bit of breathing room. But that certainly is what we're hearing from our providers is that they now expect it's a really quick turnaround time and they know that their patient can stay in the office and then receive point-of-care service. So when the patient walks out of their office, they have a plan in place.
One thing I found interesting in the study is the doctor's potential other avenues of action had they not been able to access this. So why don't you speak on that a little bit and how detrimental that could be if this program doesn't stay or, you know, even grow so that this is their first cause of action?
Sure. So one of the key questions that Dr. Wickman asks at the end of every encounter is, if you had not reached us today, what would you have done? And the data from that are rather revealing. The majority of them, 42% of those who answered, would have made a medication-related adjustment. And that may have been increasing a dose, decreasing a dose of a medication, changing it when it shouldn't have been changed. There are a small percentage that Dr. Quickman confirms that there wouldn't have been a change. And so that gives that provider that confidence to know that they were following the right path. However, another sizable portion of providers would have referred the patient to another provider. So that would have been a mental health professional who could do a diagnostic evaluation. And what we know is that women who receive these referrals don't always, and in fact, most often, don't access those referrals. So in essence, by a provider making a referral that never gets accessed, you are delaying care and you are reducing missed care opportunities by that patient walking out with that plan at the time when they saw their provider.
And we're not necessarily saying to our providers to not refer to a different provider. We're not saying don't refer to mental health, don't send them to a therapist or a psychiatrist, by no means. But we also recognize that there's such a delay in mental health care that that there isn't great access here in the Milwaukee area or certainly across the state. But so we know that there is going to be a delay of care even if that patient makes it to that appointment. Mm-hmm. So the Periscope Project can oftentimes be a bridge to that next appointment. So a provider, an OB or a primary care doctor can implement a plan, get them started with a medication, maybe get a therapy referral, and still put in a psychiatry referral. But then by the time that psychiatry referral happens in 2 or 3 months, at least that patient's already been put on the right path rather than having no care at all in those intervening months.
I know you've gotten a lot of feedback from the doctors who are helping out these mothers. Is there any way you're getting feedback from the mothers, either through what the doctors are saying or through direct responses?
So we're not targeting the patients themselves. It really is a provider-to-provider service. The providers that kind of indirectly tell us is that the patients are so grateful that these things are being addressed and that they have a plan in place by the time they leave their office. And so we're hearing that directly from the providers, but not directly from the patients themselves.
Is there also an increase in the physician's comfort in helping to manage these type of problems and being able to prompt the conversation, especially if mothers aren't comfortable in admitting I'm having problems with my mental health or things like that? Are they being more proactive about addressing these things?
I think so. And certainly that's what our data would like. We would like our data to be able to show over time because they now have some tools and some backup support. They may be more comfortable in doing some screening and initial screening questions because they know now that if they have a positive screen or if their mother is struggling, they know what to do, even if it's just picking up the phone and talking through that clinical case scenario with the psychiatrist through the Periscope Project. But at least they've got a backup plan in place. Whereas before, if they had no support, a lot of providers are hesitant to even do a screening tool because if it's positive, well, I don't know what to do next and I don't know where to send them and I don't know what my next steps are.
I would say that one area where we see this demonstrated is with pediatricians. So if you have a pediatrician who has a mom who is questioning, should I be breastfeeding or not, that is a group of providers where we have a real opportunity to increase their confidence to be able to counsel mothers in an informed manner.
So Jennifer, you've been involved in building the program, seeing the results. Where are you seeing the needle move and where do critical gaps still remain? And what new things do you think you're going to try and implement as you're getting these numbers? Are there adjustments that you're thinking of already?
We're actually making adjustments continually all the time. You know, we want as many providers to utilize the service to make it as easy as possible. As far as critical gaps go, we're looking to sustain the service long term. And so if we are meeting a need and we can demonstrate our effectiveness long term, then securing the funding and the mechanism for reimbursing this service long term is important to us.
Yeah, that's a big question is, you know, can this be sustained? And I know it was part of Frater to UW-Milwaukee and a grant. Mm-hmm. So what are your goals? What are your moves to in order to make doctors, healthcare groups, in order for them to realize that this is important and to make it a general standard practice?
So that's the next big question is how do we continue to show that this is an important service? And so I think a lot of what we're doing from our service-related data, i.e. the providers who are utilizing it, just our number of usage and the potential patients that we're impacting, and not just single patients, because we're impacting a provider, one's going to assume that that provider is reaching many patients' lives. So they only may need to call once or twice or three times, and then they can kind of disseminate that information to the rest of their providers. So trying to kind of demonstrate that piece, as well as with some of the economic Medicaid claims data that we're utilizing, hopefully can show an impact as well. At this point, we only have funding through the end of 2019. And so one of our big goals in the next 18 months or so is to figure out ways to continue to sustain this program. And whether that's through the state of Wisconsin with similar other teleconsultation programs, is it through the healthcare insurance companies, does this become a billable or reimbursable service? These are all things that are kind of we're kind of trying to wrap our heads around right now, because what we're hearing certainly from our users, please don't let this go away. We want to continue to have access to this program.
Right. And Jennifer, you mentioned the first time around that a health economist is also involved with this. Mm-hmm. So what kind of promising results have they been able to gather that will show that support that this is something that reduces costs across the board?
Sure. So I have the Department of Economics involved at UW-Milwaukee, and we have establish the baseline and that the data in the Medicaid claims are robust enough to be able to detect differences eventually. But this is a long-term sort of exploration that we are doing. And so the next time we'll be securing data after 1 year of the Periscope being operational. And that's coming up soon. But what we hope to demonstrate is that cost shifting that I had mentioned. If we can demonstrate that we are shifting costs from more expensive care to less expensive care, then that will be a demonstration of the kind of success that we need to show.
At the heart of this is the mothers that are seeking care. As this grows in popularity, as more healthcare providers have this service and the doctors are having these conversations with patients, do you hope that mothers will be more willing to share their struggles if doctors are more aware of this and have the office as a safe place, which oftentimes it's not for some patients?
Absolutely. That's certainly our hope, that if we can do enough education to our providers or our first-line providers, that a patient's going to feel more comfortable and have that established rapport with their provider in order to be open about the struggles that they're having. That is one thing that did shift with our initial thought about this program. We really were going to target prescribers and true healthcare professionals. But what we realized very quickly in the first few months of operation is that our true frontline providers, things like social workers, lactation consultants, nurses, home visitors, that they had such an impact on our perinatal moms as well, why shouldn't we open up this service to them too? And so we really opened up our enrollment piece and then changed it a bit so that any healthcare provider, a healthcare professional can access our service, but then we really tailor the scope of the consultation to the provider who's calling. So I'm not going to talk about medication management, say to a home visitor, but I'm going to help her interpret the results of that screening tool that she did and help her ask some of the next steps or the next questions to see if that patient's in imminent risk, or give her some community resources to get her connected to a therapist or a psychiatrist if that's what she needs.
More than half our providers are practicing in OBGYN settings, and that includes MDs or DOs, so your physician group, your midwife group, your nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. But at the same time, we have an important segment of psychiatrists calling in. So even though these are providers who are, you know, psychiatrist board certified, they may not feel comfortable to take care of some of the more complex situations where there is that subspecialty care is needed. So it's a real opportunity for a wide variety of providers of a variety of educational experience and levels to interface with us.
Well, Christina Wickman and Jennifer Deering, thank you so much for coming in to talk about it, and good luck with the next steps.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Christina Wickman is medical director of the Periscope Project. Jennifer Deering is an associate professor in the College of Nursing at UW-Milwaukee. You can find a link to the report on the Periscope Project's first 9 months and more at WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then we'll hear about the documentary on the founder of an important Los Angeles nightclub. That's when Like Fit continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Jewel Tice Williams is an important figure to people in several communities. She's the founder of the legendary Los Angeles nightclub, The Catch One. For four decades, The Catch was a place where politicians and everyday people of all colors, cultures, and backgrounds could come together and dance the night away. And more importantly, be accepted.
Tice Williams opened the club in the 1970s when racism was still rampant, as was open discrimination against LGBT people. As a Black lesbian woman, Williams says she saw the need to open a place that could serve as a sanctuary for everyone. The oldest Black-owned disco in America was not just a place to dance, but a community hub that expanded into a vegan cafe and community health center.
A recent documentary, Jewel's Catch One, chronicles the club's and its owner's journey. The documentary is just now available on Netflix. It features interviews with Sharon Stone, Thea Austin, Thelma Houston, and others. It was directed by C. Fitz, who came to Milwaukee for a screening in 2016, along with Tice Williams and performer Thea Austin. They joined us in the studio then, and Fitz starts by explaining how Jewel and The Catch One caught her attention.
I met her 6 years ago, 6.5 years ago, 2010. I volunteered to do a short piece on her, 2-3 minutes, because she was being honored for her community service. And as I initially researched her before I met her, I was like, wow, this is a lot. And by the time I did meet her in April 2010, I was just shaking my head saying, I don't know how I'm going to fit all of this into 2 to 3 minutes. We need to do a documentary on you. And she agreed. And as I researched it even more, just the massive amounts of community service, all that she built, not only Catch One, but the vegan restaurant at the time, the clinic when she was 56 that she started, the Village Health Foundation. There's just so much to cover, and it was hard putting it into 84 minutes.
Exactly. Now, Jewel, documentaries are a very timely process. They're the span of what I assume at least months, maybe a year or
more.
It took
me six years.
6 years.
Six
so
years.
Getting to know
very patient.
this whole thing over 6 years, why did you agree to take part in this project?
Well, I welcomed the fact that Fitz wanted to do it. And not only did she want to do it, but initially she financed it, she shot it, she narrated it. She was really involved in it, and how could I not? With someone wanting to really tell your story, feel like, well, maybe there is some importance to it. And little did I know that genius director-producer had crossed my path and was going to be not only doing the documentary for me, but become lifelong friends and associates too. And that was an added bonus.
Were you both nervous about anything at all?
Nervous about the volume of life, of service, of what she created and trying to fit it into one film. And over the years, we collected such beautiful interviews, not only from patrons, but patients and celebrities, and it just kept growing. And the archival photos and footage and research, just that made me nervous because her life is so huge and it's undocumented. And it was my job to do a good job in telling the world about her voice that stood up against hate and racism and homophobia. So I was definitely nervous, but I'm happy with it.
Well, and that is such an important thing, to document these places and the people who support and run them. And it's been over 40 years or more that the Catch One has meant so much to not only patrons and friends, but the LGBT community, and then more importantly, the Black LGBT community. It really was the first place in LA for the Black gay community to go. So throughout all of it, what has the club meant for you, Jewel?
Well, it, needless to say, changed my life because I grew up, for 42 of my 77 years, this was a everyday thing of eating, drinking, sleeping, and living it. I was very, very involved in it. And as a result, I grew, with it. And you'll see, or whomever sees the film will note that there were a lot of challenges and obstacles and transformations. Just changing of ideas and thoughts about a lot of things that occurred with me, in addition to coming into a place where I liked me. And that, came along with years and years of various kinds of help, of work, of change, of recovery, of spirituality. And the list goes on and on, and all of those contributed to who I am today. And at the end of our interviewing for the documentary, Fitz asked me the question about what would you change about your life, and there was some pretty horrendous things that happened over the years from early childhood on. And I was able to respond honestly that I wouldn't change anything because that end result I'm pleased with. I've worked on what it was that I came here for, and that was to help initiate change, not only for myself, but for others, and to, help take care of the planet in a beneficial way.
Now, you yourself are the heart and soul, organs, blood, everything that kept this club running. But Thea, for you as a performer side of it, what are some of your favorite memories of performing at the Catch, and what made this space different compared to other venues that you've been?
Jewel's Catch One was an amazing place for people to celebrate life, celebrate music. She had the best DJ, they played the best music, and everyone was welcome. Although it was established by Jewel for herself and the Black, lesbian, and gay community, it morphed beyond, I'm sure, what her initial dream was. She was providing a place of refuge for the community to be free, to celebrate life. For me to be welcome there, it represented a space of just high celebration in life, a place of non-discrimination. And that's what it was for me initially. My friend DJ Wayne Williams brought me there, and we were both just patrons supporting Jewel's business. And eventually, after Rhythm as a Dancer came out, and I was welcomed by Jewel to perform there several times over the course of the 90s. And in the new millennium, I went to Jewel as a patient to the Village Healthcare Foundation. Everything this lady does works. and my heart is in it. And I know my heart's in the right place for, supporting her and her club from the very beginning. There was always, for me, always goodness in it from the time I stepped into her club into this moment in NPR. Thank you for your question.
Absolutely. Yeah. Jewel, the club has as you mentioned, gone through many transformations and many obstacles, especially at the beginning, with everything from police intimidation, arrests, arson, taking a couple years to open up after that, the bureaucracy from the city, all the things that tried to keep the Catch closed. So throughout all of that, what was the source of your perseverance?
I would say that it was the spiritual connection, and then having parents that were dedicated to the success of their children, maybe not in terms of financial, but they wanted us all, and there were seven of us, to be educated, at least get our high school diplomas. And they never gave up, you know, at a time from very, 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 very humble beginnings to still every day push the possibility of hope and possibilities of achieving something, of making something out of yourself that they didn't have access to in their time and place, but they wanted it for us. And the way that they stood up, you know, my dad was a union representative at his job for the 35 years or so that he was there. And I didn't even know about it. I didn't know because he was real passive with my mom, especially. And then when I heard that he was out, you know, leading the union and marching against all of the things that we're talking about, you know, the racism and that and discrimination with the elderly because they wanted him to retire before his time. And even though, you know, when I was a kid, might not have been aware of all of these things, the residue of it stayed with me, I think, from them just being tenacious and never giving up and would not let us give up under any circumstance.
Now, with that hard work that goes into running and operating a club, you also have the other side of the patrons that come into the club every night that keep the money flowing and keep it going. But when you're struggling to reopen after the fire, you mentioned that, quote, it was a gay issue for the black people, and then it was a black and gay and female issue for the broader community. Do you find this true still today?
Sure. There's some of that exists. But for sure, also, there's been change, and there's been growth, and there's been an increase of compassion when we see the news and we see Black Lives Matter, and we see Asians and Hispanics and blacks and whites. The millennium kids are on it, you know. So the change has filtered down to them and broadened to the fact to indicate that it's real and it's really a part of a lot of young kids, whereas before their parents maybe did not feel the same way that they did. And of course, their grandparents for sure almost did not feel the same. So we have a lovely mixture.
Now, Fitz, as you've been involved in this project and getting insight into Jewel's life and the life of the Catch itself, what lessons did you learn from Jewel and what she's built?
That patience, tenacity, and perseverance pays off. I don't know how she stood up by herself to everything that she did and kept going after being burned down, after the city wouldn't give her permits, just roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. And she just kept figuring out how to open that club, open the doors on a tiny budget, and then also simultaneously build organizations like the AIDS Minority Project, because that's what was desperately needed for her community right then and there, and Ruse House, the shelter for women with AIDS and their kids. She just kept opening the doors and kept building. And so it's patience and perseverance, just like my documentary, 6 years. I never thought it would take 6 years. It's a perfect, in my mind, testament to her life so far, because she just opened a new clinic. And, you know, we could make a mini series out of it. The hardest thing was letting some of the footage go and drop to the edit floor, for sure. But it took a while to do it properly and hang in there, just like she did for her community, and keep making it right, making it better, making the film better, a better history lesson that's never been written before. So, yeah. patience and perseverance.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, there's a second community clinic opening up. And I was personally in awe and fascinated by the expansion of the Catch. You know, you built this whole corner community that was so much more than the club. And I was also curious as to why you went and got your master's in Chinese medicine. And how has practicing medicine fulfilled you in a different way compared to your role as a leader of the Catch One?
Well, I'll start off with it's pretty much the same, you know, as far as contributing to the health and welfare of the community. In Chinese medicine, we have what we call the three bao, or the three treasures, where the mind, body, and spirit are connected. And even with the points that we use and the herbs that we use, they all have emotional and spiritual as well as physical importance in using them. So I feel like it's just a continuation or an expansion as it was when I had the Catch open, of wanting to help more, an extension on providing care for folks that had AIDS and HIV. In fact, that was the first thing that first disease that I treated was that one. But it's all about the healing, and you can't separate it out. In order to be whole, it can't be all about the dance either. It has to be when you leave Catch One that you took that feeling out with you into the community about other things that are as important. So at 56, I was concerned too for my own well-being, because I have, and had in the past, when things get too familiar, too common, and too easy, then I'll want to do something else, and sometimes the something else was not the best thing for me. So I had this feeling from the time I was a kid at 11 to somehow work herbs and lifestyle changes and that sort of thing into my own life, as well as passing that information on. So at 56, I decided to go back to school, and through advice from my psychologist, he suggested, because he was seeing a patient that did acupuncture and herbs, to follow that. And I was real happy that he suggested it, because I love it. I love it. I think it's magical, the medicine.
The Catch was referred to as a victory for every person in town in LA, and how it affected them during its season. And as now you've gone around telling the story of the Catch and it's now closed, how do you both feel revisiting the Catch's history and even your history of the two of you and your relationship over the past 6 years making this film? What new things have you noticed as you've gone around, or different perspectives from different global audiences?
It's been pretty amazing, and not only just Los Angeles audiences, but audiences on the East Coast and now abroad, leaving the film inspired just by watching her life, her incredible life of 42 years, and all the things that she accomplished. So the film is really an unwritten textbook. It's an example of how one person can make a difference, how they can take their life and serve their community in a lot of different ways. So just in her life, she's giving you lots of ideas and examples of things you can do. She did them all because she's Jewel Tice Williams. But having people watch the film, watch Jewel's life, and then leaving inspired, especially now in the shadow of Orlando and senseless shootings and everything that's going on in the world today, to be a global example has been an honor. As a film, and also show the world Jewel's voice, and hopefully touch some people, inspire some people, and give them a voice within themselves, because we all can do a little more.
C. Fitz is the director, and Jewel Tice Williams is the subject of the documentary Jewel's Catch One. The film is now available on Netflix. Our interview first aired last year.
One more break, and then we're joined in the performance studio by the Milwaukee-based alt-country band Buffalo Gospel, which has a new album out and a concert this week in town. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A lot has happened to the members of Buffalo Gospel over the past 5 years. The alt-country group released their first album, We Can Be Horses, in 2013 to critical acclaim. But lead singer Ryan Nacy explains that losses, both personal and professional, delayed the release of their latest album.
Titled On the First Bell, the album explores some of the many characters from Nacy's hometown, Ixonia, Wisconsin. Nacy and bandmates Kevin Rowe, Nick Lang, and Andrew Koenig joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers for an in-studio performance. And it's a long star. Well, the good ones better, no one's better, no one left it out. And it's a long star. I said the good ones better, no one's better, no one left to call. And you're pouring honey in my ear. Yeah, we bought the barge and wound up here. Well, we went for broke and wound up bust, with a pocket full of hand and dust. And it's a long star. I said a good one's better, no one's better, no one left it out. And it's a long star. When a good one's better, no one's better, no one left to call.
Last I ride, dressed head to toe in this neon light. Well, fairly well, for I am bound for that lone star I seen shining down. And it's a lone star. When the good one's better, no one's better, no one left it out. And it's a lone star. Yes, a good run's better, no one left to call. And it's a lone star. Yes, a lone star. There's a lone star.
Lone Star from Buffalo Gospel. Guys, thank you so much for being in the studio today.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
When were you last here?
It was probably 2015. We were here with Trapper to talk about our first record. Yeah, it's been a long time.
It's been a bit. Yeah, it's been a minute. Well, thank you so much for coming back in.
Yeah, well, we're always happy to come in and talk about ourselves a little bit.
Good. Well, we're happy to have you talk about yourselves.
Awesome.
So, speaking of yourselves, you're all from Wisconsin, right?
Yep.
Yeah, we
That's
are.
Right.
I find it fascinating that, like, a group of guys from Wisconsin somehow found their way to alt country. What was that trip like? Did you grow up country fans?
I did, for sure. That was my dad's record collection, was John Prine and Emmylou Harris and singer-songwriters like that. And he had some Hank Williams. And I didn't even know it, but I was kind of being indoctrinated from a very early age. So when it came time to put something together that I really wanted to play, this is sort of what came out.
What is it about country music, alternative country music, that you think speaks to your experience growing up in a small town in Wisconsin?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, it was there was a lot of, you know, the blue collar, the stories that singer-songwriters write about, the kind of lonesome feeling, I guess. You know, the town I grew up in, Exonia, was kind of more of a blue collar farm town. And there was definitely, again, like I didn't notice it at the time, but in hindsight, there was a lot of inspiration there, I think. Some of those characters that I saw every day going to school and, you know, friends, parents, and things like that. But yeah, I think that's kind of how it connects. I love telling stories, and that's kind of what I'm drawn to as far as music goes. So it just all kind of works out in the end.
What does the alternative country music scene look like in Milwaukee and Wisconsin more generally, but especially Milwaukee? That's where we are right now.
You want to take that one?
You're asking the guy from Madison what it looks like in Milwaukee. So.
Well, Madison too. What does it look like in Wisconsin? Because I don't think of us as being really a country state, but there is a big folk music scene. Is that kind of where it crosses over?
Yeah, it's all tied in. It's all tied in there. I think there's a growing scene too. There's a bunch of bands in Milwaukee right now that are kind of up and coming with the folky, bluegrassy kind of scene, and that ties right into Americana country. There's a number of friends that we have, and we've made kind of those connections through the years of people that we like, people that we like playing with, and we kind of just we're filling the niche in the Milwaukee scene that we want to see. We want to hear this kind of music, and we weren't hearing a lot of it, so we got to make it.
Yeah.
Right.
So the last album came out about 5 years ago. What was it like 5 years ago versus now?
I actually feel like there were probably more people doing this sort of thing back then, and it seems like it's maybe gone a little more in the rock direction than the country direction, which is fine. It's just more room for us to spread out, I guess. But there's still a handful of people doing it and doing it really well. But yeah, I think there were a lot more people doing the singer-songwriter thing, in my opinion, back then. But there, like I said, there's still some really, really great talent in Milwaukee. It's inspiring when we go to other cities and we realize how deep that pool runs here. You know?
Yeah. All right. Well, you have another song for us, 18 Wheeler.
Yeah.
Is there anything we should know?
It's a truck driving song.
Yeah.
Which, you know, a bunch of guys from Wisconsin that have never driven a truck. That's exactly what we should be writing about, right?
All right.
She come a long, long way for a good old boy and a letter from the interstate. She said, I love you, little girl, and I want to make you mine, but don't you go and make me wait. Well, she should have known better when she saw that the letter was written on a motel bell. But by the time he'd arrived, she was blind with the signs of loving in her wedding bells. How do you send the letters to an 18-wheeler? How you fall in love with a driving man? You take a good long look before I up and leave you, and you're sitting there waiting on the wheels again. Well, he woke in the nighttime carrying on, saying, brother, what have you done? You know your boots are burning and a truck is falling. If you hurry, you got time to run. Well, she headed down the road with the letter that he wrote and a smile right across her face. Lord, he never even seen her doing 103 when he passed her going the other way. How do you send love letters to a 18-wheeler? How you fall in love with a driving man? You take a good long look before he up and leaves you, and you're sitting here waiting on the wheels again. Huh. Cigarette smoke, she's waiting in the bed alone. Never mind playing wife, she'd have settled for a call, but she's waiting on the telephone. Well, she got herself a job where she heard he drinks, and she's waiting for her day to come. Oh, daddy rolls into town, and he's settling down, and he's rambling a desert down.
I do send love letters to an 18-wheeler. How you fall in love with a driving man? You take a good long look before I up and leave you. And you're sitting here waiting on the wheels again. I said you're sitting here waiting on the wheels, oh, again.
"18-Wheeler" from Buffalo Gospel. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So is that from the new album?
It is from the new album. Yeah, all these ones are from.
Okay, nice.
Yep.
New album, On the First Bell. It's the second album after We Can Be Horses.
Yes.
5 years later, we've talked about how the alt-country scene has changed in Milwaukee, but how have you changed as a group, and how is that reflected in this album?
We have had some personnel switch over. It's been the project really started as an outlet for me to write songs and be in the studio, and I never really anticipated it becoming a sort of a traveling sideshow thing that it has become. But once we started putting things out and people responded to it, it seemed like there was a market for it, and people were interested in seeing us play it. So we had to kind of shift gears and find the folks that it made sense to take out on the road. And the older you get, the harder it is to find people that are willing to do that sort of thing. So it's finding the right combination of personalities, and yeah, I think we're getting there.
And Ryan, I'm putting you on the spot right now, but you've changed a lot over the last 5 years too.
Yeah. Yeah. On a personal level, a lot of things have happened, and that's kind of what delayed the second album. Just sort of life in general. I was in a much darker place 5 years ago, and I'm in a much lighter place now, so I'm having a lot more fun doing this stuff for sure.
So a more fun album.
There's still a lot of death. And, yeah, there's still a lot of drinking and a lot of death.
Yeah, fun with alt country is just happy songs, but same themes.
Yeah. But maybe a little more hopeful than the first one. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So earlier you talked about the kinds of characters in the town that you grew up in. Who are the characters that we can expect to see in or hear about in these songs? Who are the characters that come out?
Oh, that's a tough one because I usually don't like to give that away.
Okay.
And I'm not trying to be difficult with you, but I do enjoy talking to people and letting them sort of live inside these songs and hopefully leave it abstract enough that they can connect with it. And that's sort of what I love about the genre myself, and I don't really want to steal that fun away from people. I mean, I can say there's a lot of influence. We had a founding member that his name was Josh Tovar, and he was just a wonderful guitar player, and he was kind of the guy that helped me get this band up and running. And he passed away a few years ago, and that was definitely had a... There's a lot of him on this record. You know, there's a lot of that story woven throughout it, and me kind of figuring out a way to cope with that because I'd never really lost anybody my age or a close friend. And so, yeah, I can give that away. But I think it's probably pretty obvious to anyone that knows me that's what a lot of these stories are centered around.
A kind of tribute to him.
Yeah, absolutely. And he deserves it. Just a quality guy.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you recorded the album pretty recently over at The Hive just outside of Eau Claire. What was that experience like, recording in that space?
It was, we were away from everything, which was great. It was like very little phone reception, and Brian Joseph, the engineer, was kind enough to put us up at his house while he just stayed down the street. So we'd just hang out together, live together, eat together, and then we'd just wake up every day and walk down the hill and just spend all day there. It was really like a nice meditation on this music, too.
Yeah, it's a beautiful spot, just right along the Chippewa River in Eau Claire. And Eau Claire is where Ryan and I met, and that's where we first started playing music together, and kind of meant a lot to go back to Eau Claire and find someone of such international caliber like Brian Joseph and find the perfect space, you know, just... Like Nick said, walk down to the studio in the morning, just feel free to take our time and relax as part of the process. And it's such a beautiful spot and a beautiful studio and a great human being in Brian, too.
Yeah, Brian has worked with Bon Iver, Indigo Girls, I wrote down another one, Sufjan Stevens. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How much does the engineer really impact the sound of an album?
For me, it was Brian's personality. I'm kind of he's obviously incredibly talented. When you look at his resume, it just kind of speaks for itself. And when you listen to the records that he's worked on, they're stunning. But for me, I'm kind of an introverted person. I'm kind of a shy person also. So to have a guy, he's the sweetest guy in the world. And he's just there enough when you need him. You know what I mean? He's not right down your throat all the time. He's got wonderful ideas, but he also understands that making sure the musicians are comfortable both physically and emotionally is like tantamount to getting a good recording, you know? So that was the thing I valued the most was just how good of a person Brian is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's a good enough engineer where he can tell you, oh yeah, I think you guys should do another take on that one. Yeah. But also not pushy, like, I think you should do it like this. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just the sweetest guy. Yeah. Pleasure to work with.
So you have one more song for us. It's High Time to Hang Fire. Is there anything we should know about it?
It's kind of about, losing somebody close to you and not getting a chance to say goodbye to them, which I think happens a lot. And again, just trying to figure out a way to cope with that and put something out into the air that hopefully they're able to receive, you know?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us here in studio and sharing your music with us.
Thanks for having us. It's an honor. Appreciate it.
Well, I'm fairly certain the red dirt on my window bank.
Buffalo Gospel is a local alt-country band led by Ryan Nacy. Kevin Rowe plays the string bass. Nick Lang is on drums, and Andrew Koenig plays the electric guitar.
Their second album, On the First Bell, is out this week, and they'll be holding an album release show this Saturday at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point. They spoke with Joy Powers, and our in-studio session was engineered by Jason Reavy. There is more information at WUWM.com.
And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
Time to hang fire. A trick of the light on the day you were gone. Ooh, it's high time to hang fire. Chase this guilt with regret. Hellos with goodbye.